Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll look back at a catastrophe along the Chicago River. It killed more than 800 people.
I think that no one was found criminally responsible for the deaths of 844 people, many women and children, is one of the great injustices of the 20th century.
We'll discuss the Eastland disaster with an author who has investigated the event. We'll also remember a late civil rights leader from Illinois. And we'll talk with some people trying to start a business during such an uncertain time and hear challenges facing new teachers as they begin their careers amid a pandemic. That and more this hour on Statewide. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, for some, starting their own business is a dream, but try doing it during a pandemic. We'll hear from some entrepreneurs. We'll also look back on a deadly day in Chicago, where more than 800 people died after boarding a ship known as the Eastland. We'll also get an update on Bruno the Bear. That and more this hour. We begin this week with a life filled with achievement that has come to an end. The Reverend C.T. Vivian died last Friday, just a couple of weeks shy of his 96th birthday. He grew up in Macomb and went on to become a leader in the American civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. Rich Egger has this remembrance.
Dr. Vivian last paid a visit to Macomb in October 2015. It was a busy three-day trip. He served as Grand Marshal for Western Illinois University's homecoming parade. The day before, the city held a ceremony to name a stretch of Highway 67 in his honor. In addition, he gave a speech to a full house at the Macomb Junior Senior High School Auditorium, and the district named the High School Library in his honor. Vivian said the books he read while in school influenced him. He also said he learned from standing up to a schoolyard bully while attending Lincoln Elementary.
Everything that's happened since then came from the fact that I realized you never take what you know is inhuman treatment.
Dr. Vivian headed to Peoria after leaving Western Illinois University. His goal in Peoria was to integrate lunch counters. His success there caught the attention of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and Vivian worked alongside King during the Civil Rights Movement, which used nonviolent means to bring about change.
Nonviolence always will be the answer. The participants have to be able to be nonviolent. That is the issue.
That's Vivian during a video interview 10 years ago with J.Q. Adams, who taught at Western. Vivian said activists in the 1950s and 60s trained in nonviolent tactics.
It wasn't like we were just stepped off the street and said, I want to do something, right? And we were well trained.
During the civil rights movement, Vivian risked his life to help organize the Freedom Rides and register voters in Alabama. He later directed the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he provided civil rights counsel to Presidents Johnson, Carter, Reagan, Clinton, and Obama. President Obama honored Vivian with the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2013. That's the nation's highest civilian honor. Tammy Lee Brown Edwards is the first black female member of the Macomb City Council, so she's a trailblazer, too. She says Vivian was a quiet force.
He helped desegregate lunch counters, swimming pools, beaches. He went face-to-face with Bull Connor. There's plenty of pictures of that. He is the epitome of nonviolent civil rights.
The Reverend C.T. Vivian pushed for nonviolent change throughout his adult life. During his final visit to Macomb, he decried the influx of money in politics. He said billionaires put huge sums of money into electing their own people, and the Supreme Court was allowing money to be used as the vote.
How long will we have before we do not really have a democratic society? That's the real fear. And I hope before I die, I will at least be in on that.
Dr. Vivian did not live long enough to see that change come about. But during his long life, he played a pivotal role in advancing social justice and promoting racial equality. And during that final trip to the place where he grew into a leader, Vivian said he believed the day has passed when movements need a great leader. He said he felt that instead, progress should come from people believing in democracy and decency. Rich Egger reporting.
This week marks 105 years since a horrific scene along the Chicago River. Yet many have never heard about the Eastland disaster. The ship overturned and 844 people died just a few feet from shore. Michael McCarthy is the author of the book Ashes Underwater, the SS Eastland and the Shipwreck That Shook America. We talked with him previously. We revisit that conversation this week. McCarthy takes us back to that fateful day in July 1915.
We are on a misty Saturday morning in July of 1915, and it's about 7 in the morning, and this steamship, large steamship that is as large as a football field, is loading up with 2,500 people. Most of them are factory workers, poor, a lot of women and children. The ship goes into a half an hour sort of sequence of topsy-turvy behavior in which it spins, it begins to turn toward the dock, turns away from the dock, it turns back toward the dock, and eventually it spins completely over. It lands on its side. It's at the Chicago River. It's immediately fills with water, and 844 people drowned within minutes.
What caused this shifting of the ship?
What exactly happened? We haven't known. We haven't known in the past 100 years since the tragedy what caused it. And what I found in digging through National Archives records is that there was actually a plausible explanation. What we can see from the evidence that prosecutors gathered was that there were cruel business owners who ran the ship, who knew the ship had stability problems. They began discussing specific repairs to fix water pipe stabilizing machinery deep in the hull of the ship, and then they neglected to follow through. Cutting corners, they decided to wait until the 1915 sailing season was over, and that cost the Eastland victims their lives. And I think that they neglected the needed repairs is not an author's speculation or theory. This is the explanation that vividly emerges from the evidence that was painstakingly gathered by the police and prosecutors in the summer of 1915. I think that no one was found criminally responsible for the deaths of 844 people, many women and children, as I mentioned, is one of the great injustices of the 20th century.
For a lot of people, it might be hard to imagine that something along the Chicago River there could lead to such great loss of life. It doesn't seem like it's that far away from land or maybe the dock in this situation. You know, why weren't people able to get back to the surface and possibly be rescued?
Yeah, the scene was incredibly chaotic. You have to imagine the Chicago River at the point at which the Eastland sank, it was just about 19 feet from its dock. So people literally could almost reach across and they could almost leap to the ship or leap to the dock. The problem was that the way the ship sank and the way the ship was designed, there was really only one main stairwell out from the middle decks out to the top. That stairwell quickly became stampeded by all the people trying to get out and clogged, and essentially everyone then was blocked from being able to exit the ship. The other thing is, it's a horrible scene to think about. This is a ship that suddenly turns sideways. So think if you're in a house and it's sideways. Think about a stairwell that normally would go up. It's now going sideways, and if you try to step on a stair tread, you're simply going to slide down. On top of that, you're in a ship that has corridors. You're trying to wind your way out. It's as if you're in a maze that's turned sideways. So nothing is working for a smooth exit. Okay, say you manage to get out and you're up at the top of the water. People are clawing and screaming and flailing in the water. And there are instances we know of men who didn't know how to swim, grabbing hold of young women and drowning them. I mean, it was a tremendously chaotic scene. On top of that, there was a lot of debris that was thrown. This is the place this happened on the Chicago River was in a warehouse district, largely a fruit production area and fruit retailing area. So there were a lot of crates that were being thrown in, crates for fruit, life preservers, all kinds of debris is flying down. Some of it hit people in the head and knocked them unconscious. And, on top of numerous other complications, the women were in very typical apparel for a nice day out in the summer, a summer picnic, which would have been ankle-length dresses and skirts and shirtwaists and so forth. So they're not exactly in the best apparel suddenly to be dumped in a river and trying to swim. So for all these reasons, the tremendous loss of life.
We're talking with Michael McCarthy. He's the author of Ashes Underwater. It focuses on the Eastland disaster. Why, as a society, is this so forgotten? I mean, this is a tremendous loss of life. It happened right here in Illinois. I bet most people don't even remember it.
You know, I'm ashamed to say I didn't know about it. If you think about it, I lived and worked. I grew up in St. Louis, lived and worked in Chicago for about 7 or 8 years with the Wall Street Journal before I'd ever heard about it. And so I was one of the, people who was kind of blindsided by it. But, it's a very good question. Why have people forgotten? Well, I think there's a couple good reasons. One is that none of the passengers on the ship were affluent or prosperous or celebrities, right? So when we had the Titanic, we had the unsinkable Molly Brown and some other rich aristocrats who died. In the case of the Eastland, it was all factory workers. There was one particular factory in Chicago called Western Electric. They made, if you can remember those, it's called the candlestick phone. It's the phone in which it's like tall, looks like a candlestick. You'd remove the receiver and hold it up to your ear. The Western Electric Company was the only producer of phones in the United States. It was right there in Chicago. And they were having a company picnic. So most of the employees were on the Eastland at the time it sank. So these were not well-known people. These were not people who write memoirs or would be normally written up in the newspapers if they died. Okay, aside from that, immediately after this happens, the accident happens in July of 1915. There's a trial in 1916 to try and bring those responsible to justice. By 1917, the United States is in World War I, and that really changed a lot. And I think that the Eastland story got buried in the absolute world-changing events of World War I. And I think that's a problem. And finally, I think one of the reasons it's been forgotten is because, like I said, until I did my research and wrote my book, we haven't really had anyone to blame. There was no one really guilty. It just seemed like the boat tipped over and no one knew why. And I think that probably kept it from being a legacy of history that we would know about, something that we would know, like the Lusitania or the Titanic.
Well, mentioning the legacy of the Eastland, I was surprised to learn that the ship itself continued on sort of in a second life, and it involved the military.
It did. Well, after the sinking, it took them a month before they actually could pump it out, raise it back up, and figure out what to do with it. At this point, the military, the Navy, took over the ship. They cut a couple decks off of it because, they decided they were going to use it as a training vessel. For military maneuvers, for naval maneuvers, and they didn't need all the cabin space that you would use for a cruise ship for passengers. They also made key changes to the stability system that the Eastland owners had contemplated doing, but failed to do. So once the mechanical flaws, once the fatal mechanical flaws were repaired, the ship was perfectly fine. But unfortunately for all the victims of the Eastland, that hadn't been done until the Navy had taken the ship over.
What can society learn from something that happened so long ago?
It's a great question. And I think it's always important to expose how calamity can result when corporations put profit in front of people's safety. The Japanese company that has the airbags in autos that have led to fatalities, and Congress is after them. We have the auto industry, which had congressional hearings and problems of their own with you know, mechanical flaws that have led to people's death. So anytime we have a story that shows how this can happen, the efforts to bring people to justice, and how those efforts can be thwarted, I think there's some good lessons for us. And particularly, you know, when you think about the transportation industry, which is all I'm talking about now, whether auto or ship, you're moving many hundreds of people. In the case of autos, you know, millions of people. And so when something's wrong, those numbers can quickly mushroom, very quickly mushroom. And for Illinois or for Chicago, just even to talk about a little local relevance, there are thousands of descendants in Chicago and elsewhere, relatives of Eastland victims, who really deserve to know the full story of how and why their family members perished horribly. There were 22 whole families who died on the Eastland. As I mentioned, this is a company picnic, so maybe the father worked in a cable department. He would bring his wife. They'd bring their children. Often there was a grandmother living in the house. That whole family went on the Eastland. There were many of those. And 22 entire families died on a single day, within minutes there on the Chicago River. And given that, when I think about that, I realize that this historic tragedy changed the architecture of family trees forever.
Michael McCarthy is the author of Ashes Underwater, the SS Eastland and the Shipwreck That Shook America. The Eastland disaster happened along the Chicago River 105 years ago this week. 844 people died. Along the river, there is a marker that commemorates the event. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker is giving some more time to those behind on rent or mortgage payments. He's extending a ban on evictions through August 22nd. A moratorium was set to expire at the end of this month.
For many people, their ability to weather this crisis hinges on their ability to keep a roof over their families' heads. It's not enough to say that we want to build a more just and equitable state on the other side of this pandemic. We have to take tangible action to get there.
That action includes a new program designed to get as much as $300 million to renters and homeowners who need help. Applications will be opening next month. Eligibility will be based on income and missed housing payments. On the way on Statewide, a Lincoln presenter takes his program online. That's next. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, how healthcare workers are dealing with the stress of the COVID-19 pandemic, and what about the mental health of farmers and the challenges they're facing? We'll have more on that as well, all coming up on Statewide. Next, many artists have had to put their shows on hold due to COVID-19. An Abraham Lincoln presenter found himself in the same boat until he had a conversation with a musician friend. Yvonne Booz has more details.
Good evening, citizens of Freeport.
George Buss has presented himself as Lincoln for the past 30 years. He became a full-time Lincoln presenter after he retired from teaching. He says his interest in Lincoln was piqued as he read a history book in seventh grade. It mentioned the city of Freeport.
I remember looking and noting in my mind that that was a nationally published textbook. It wasn't something local. And I thought, Freeport made this textbook. That really had an effect on me. And then, of course, it was like, well, what did happen here?
Buss had performances lined up for 2020. Then Governor J.B. Pritzker issued a stay-at-home order.
To say, you're going to be at home. You've got to wear a mask when you're out. You know, you need 6-foot distance. That's difficult for me personally. But then to say, the audiences are not going to assemble. So I equate it to a level of grief and loss.
One of the programs that Buss does is called Lincoln the Great Communicator. Together with his friend and the help of others, the show went virtual. The first virtual show was hosted by the Looking for Lincoln Heritage Coalition in the city of Freeport. It took place on July 15th.
George and I worked together many times, and I felt a very natural rapport with him. And we had kind of loosely tossed the idea, hey, we should do something together. And then eventually sat down and literally created the show.
That was Chris Valillo. He is a singer-songwriter and folk musician who has done musical projects that include music from the Lincoln era. He says it was hard to hear that they weren't going to perform a show that they had worked so hard preparing for.
There were conversations pretty early on about what can we do about that. And at one point, Looking for Lincoln asked about the possibility of simply running a video of the show. And George and I both felt pretty strongly that we wanted to do a live performance somehow, rather than just tape it and put it up one time and repeat it.
Belillo says there is something special about a live performance. He says he and Buzz got together and presented this idea to the coalition. Belillo says having a virtual show has its challenges.
There's always that element of energy that goes back and forth between a performer and an audience. And we don't have that. When you know, doing a live stream, it's a different medium.
But Buzz says he figured out a way to compensate for this.
And I was following on the social media I had on my podium on the right-hand side, so I could see comments being made during the presentation, and they were all very heartfelt. So that let me know that, you know, people were engaged.
Another thing the two did was act as an audience for each other.
Remember that one, sir?
Oh, Chris.
That was Buzz clapping for Chris after a song ended. The show transitions back and forth from storytelling to music. Belillo says there were some favorite moments during his performances.
I loved Run to Jesus.
Run to Jesus, shun the danger.
I think that is such an amazing story of the power of music, that this is the impetus that Frederick Douglass sparks in his mind, the idea to escape slavery.
Belillo says the message of Lincoln, the great communicator, is something that needs to be heard in today's environment.
I think we look at a leader like Abraham Lincoln, who dealt with so many difficult things and so much vicious politics. And I think there's valuable lessons to learn from that.
Buzz says he can see these shows taking place even after COVID-19.
And I certainly think that looking for Lincoln and the Abraham Lincoln National Heritage Area will take advantage of that technology, especially now that we've been through it.
Buzz says doing things virtually will do for now, but the loss of human contact, not just for him, but for humanity, is causing people to pause and reflect. I'm Yvonne Booz.
When Johnny comes marching home again, hurrah.
Soon after the coronavirus pandemic hit Illinois, experts started sounding the alarm that it would begin impacting the mental health of frontline workers fighting it. Back then, numerous doctors and nurses said a chaotic and stressful work life was harming their emotional well-being. Mariah Wolfel, who's a reporter with WBEZ, checked back with some of them to find out how the pandemic has changed their lives since.
I want to reintroduce you to three different healthcare workers. First, Mita Shaw, an emergency room doctor at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. When we spoke in May, Shaw wasn't planning on getting mental health care to manage stress during the pandemic. She said she felt lucky to have friends and family to rely on instead, and spoke about the stigma healthcare workers face.
People don't want to talk about how they're feeling because they don't want to look weak to their colleagues. I just think that, unfortunately, it is the culture we've kind of created.
But when we talked again this month, Shaw told me the emotional toll of the pandemic eventually became too much to bear. She ended up scheduling an appointment with a mental health provider.
I was feeling a little crushed by my imposter syndrome. I was like, knew that I could go to work and be a physician, but I was like, maybe I'm not good enough. And I was definitely feeling like, I mean, to be honest, I was just feeling like I was failing as a mom. And I just was worrying excessively about things that I couldn't control. I was having some trouble sleeping. And I think like that was my breaking point where I was like, I need to talk to somebody other than my friends and my family.
Next, Falguni Dave, a nurse who led a COVID unit at Stroger Hospital on Chicago's West Side. At the height of the pandemic this spring, Dave moved out of her home into an apartment in the city alone. It was closer to work, but away from her husband and kids, who she wanted to protect from the virus.
I've never lived by myself in my whole entire life, so that was a challenge. You know, most of the time, I didn't want to cook for myself. I would just eat whatever is there if I ate at all. My routines really became distorted.
Now, Dave is back at home with her family, and the unit she works on at Stroger is no longer dedicated to COVID patients. She even got to take a family hiking trip to North Carolina on some days off recently. But Dave, a steward for the nurses' union, says she's still fighting to get extra so-called hazard pay for her work during the first surge.
It feels like our lives aren't valued. Our work isn't valued. Our families aren't valued. Like, we're expendable, that it's okay if we get sick, but they don't deem necessary that they need to pay us any additional money for the hazard that we're putting ourselves through.
And last, Dr. Zahir Solul. He's a pulmonologist at St. Anthony Hospital in Chicago and Advocate Christ Medical Center in Oak Lawn. When we spoke in May, Solul, who has in the past gone on medical missions to Syria, Gaza, and Yemen, he compared his COVID unit to a war zone.
We have very limited resources. So dealing with limited resources, your main concern is which patient I should direct my attention to because they're more likely to live.
Now, instead of 300 COVID patients filling five floors at his hospital, he says there's just one COVID floor with about 75 people. And for better or worse, he says the surge taught him a lot about treating COVID patients.
Our knowledge of how to manage these patients definitely is now, I would say, more evolved and mature than a couple of months ago. Even if we have a surge, which everyone expects because of the opening of the economy, I think we'll be more prepared to deal with these patients.
All three healthcare workers say the lull of the past month has allowed them to recuperate. So if another surge does come, they say they're ready. Mariah Wolfel, WBEZ News.
Studies have found higher rates of mental illness and suicide for farmers. Now the COVID-19 pandemic has farmers facing unprecedented challenges. And as Natalie Krebs with Harvest Public Media reports, this has some worried about a mental health crisis in that community.
Bill Tenninger has been a hog farmer for 50 years. He's been through droughts, market crashes, and even other viral outbreaks. But he says this pandemic is unlike any of those.
So we've experienced everything, and I got to tell you, I have never seen anything like this in all the years that I've operated.
Tenninger operates a farm in the northwest Iowa town of Lamars, and he's on the National Pork Board. He says since pork processing facilities have slowed due to the COVID-19 outbreaks in the workforce, he's been struggling with what to do with 2,500 excess pigs.
You know, if we don't get more of them moved, the next group of pigs moves up and that number is going to start increasing. Basically, I'm using up my retirement plan to, you know, to continue to operate.
Many farmers like Tenninger are under an extreme amount of stress from the pandemic. David Brown is a behavioral health specialist with Iowa State University Extension. He says he's anticipating seeing more farmers struggle.
We may see more concerns related to alcohol abuse, concerns related to depression, some forms of trauma if they are euthanizing livestock, things like that. We're also concerned about a potential spike in suicides.
Groups such as the Farm Bureau and Iowa Pork Industry Center have been sending out resources to farmers on managing their mental health and stress. But the financial toll has already been devastating. Family farms filing for bankruptcy jumped 23% in March. Mental health advocates say this financial stress can quickly trickle down. Tammy Jacobs is the coordinator of the Iowa Concern Hotline, which helps farmers with financial, legal, and mental health concerns.
Those financial concerns will always lead to, you know, relationship issues, issues within the family, concerns about how they're going to continue to be able to keep on farming.
Jacob says Iowa Concern is creating a new state-funded program to help farmers deal with the effects of COVID-19. She says one part of the new program will try to steer farmers who call in for financial help to counseling. But the COVID-19-related stress for farmers isn't all financial. Some farmers may be facing traumatic experiences from having to do things like euthanize healthy animals.
They're going to be reflecting back on all of the things they're going through, and some of them are definitely going to have PTSD.
That's Ted Matthews. He's the director of Minnesota Rural Mental Health. Matthews has worked with farmers for decades, and he says it can be hard for them to seek help. That's because so many feel their outcome and even their identity is tied to working hard.
I found that in working with farmers, you have to look at them differently than other occupations, because to them, it's not an occupation, it's a way of life.
But Matthew says many farmers need to learn to cope with the things they don't have control over. Kevin Dietzel says it took him a while to seek help for his depression, which started when he opened his dairy farm in Jewell, Iowa a few years ago. He says he struggled working long hours all alone while making no profit.
That's when depression started to really kick in a really hard way, and then I started to have days where I just I almost couldn't get up and function.
Dietzel says he understands why farmers might not seek help, even now.
I think there are, within this sort of male-dominated, macho farming community, I think there's still a lot of people that would not admit to, you know, having a problem or wouldn't want to deal with it in that way.
Dietzel says he continues to get help today. He says it's one of the ways he's able to cope with the pandemic now. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Natalie Krebs.
Support for Statewide comes from AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. As many universities prepare to welcome students back to campus, some are counting on widespread COVID-19 testing to help clamp down on potential outbreaks. Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman has a look at the testing approach at one big state university.
Large white tents have been popping up across the University of Illinois campus lately. On a sunny summer day in Urbana, graduate student Kristen Munoz approaches a table in one of those tents. She presents her ID and gets a plastic tube. Then she walks to a spot marked on the ground and takes a minute or so to collect her saliva in the tube.
It's just like a couple spits. This seems to be a lot easier than sticking a cotton swab up your nose.
She closes the tube and places it into a bag labeled biohazard. In just a few hours, she'll get the results, negative. University of Illinois chemist Martin Burke is one of the researchers who developed the test being used here. They're still calculating the cost, but he says it's much lower than standard tests. And by doing both sample collection and analysis on site, the university avoids the backlogs we're seeing at many public health and commercial labs. The plan is to offer free tests to all of the 50,000 students returning this fall, plus about 11,000 university employees.
The exciting thing is because we can test up to 10,000 per day, it allows the scientist to do what's really the best for trying to protect the community as opposed to having to cut corners because of the limitations of the testing.
Research is still preliminary, but the campus's own studies and early results from other labs show spit tests are as accurate, if not more so, than nasal swab tests. And Burke says since the test is not invasive, it's not only more convenient, but it spares the campus from burning through protective equipment and avoids supply chain bottlenecks. Around the U.S., some campuses reopening for the fall have announced similar testing programs, but many others are limiting tests to those with symptoms or known exposure to someone with COVID-19. Epidemiologist Becky Smith of the University of Illinois says data suggests campuses need to test everyone twice a week. That's because when a person gets infected, a detectable amount of virus doesn't show up in their system for 3 or 4 days.
But about 2 days after that, your infectiousness peaks. So we have a very small window of time in which to catch people before they have done most of the infection that they're going to be doing.
David Paltiel is a professor of public health policy at Yale, whose research helped inform the approach at Illinois. He says mask wearing and social distancing are important, but those measures must be coupled with retesting everyone every few days.
I am painfully aware of the fact that this sets a very high bar, logistically, financially, behaviorally, that may very well be beyond the capacity of many universities and their students in their care.
Still, the consequences of an outbreak, he says, are severe, and those harmed will be the most vulnerable on campus and in the community. Paltiel disagrees with CDC guidance for higher ed institutions, which say there's not enough data to know if testing everyone reentering campus is effective. The COVID-19 plan on Yale's website says all students will be tested upon arrival and will be required to retest weekly throughout the semester. Smith says support from the University of Illinois early on helped researchers as they hustled to get the test ready for fall reopening. Lately, she's been contacted by other schools wanting to adopt a similar program.
Everything that we are doing, we are documenting, and we are making it open source, and we are sharing with any university who contacts us.
While the Urbana Campus Lab has been certified to use the tests, researchers are still working on getting FDA clearance for other labs to adopt it. Meanwhile, hundreds of staff and students here for the summer have been moving through the COVID-19 testing tents, and Smith says they'll be ready when tens of thousands more arrive in August. I'm Christine Herman, Side Effects Public Media.
And there's more ahead. What's happened with Bruno the Bear? We'll bring you an update next. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Just like every school year, new teachers will be entering the classroom soon, but there are more challenges for this year's class of rookie educators. That story is still on the way. Now an update on that bear that had been traveling through Illinois and attracting plenty of crowds. He was nicknamed Bruno. Remember, he entered Illinois from Wisconsin this spring, and a close watch was kept on his travels. He moved into west central Illinois, then swam across the Mississippi River, crossing into Missouri near Aylesbury. He then continued south to near Wentzville, which is near St. Louis, when he became stuck between some major highways north of I-70 and near Interstate 40. Conservation workers there tranquilized Bruno, tagged him, and moved him to a more suitable area, then released the bear. We checked in with Missouri officials this week to get the latest on Bruno. They said since he was released, he ventured on south through the Missouri Ozarks. He was last reported in northern Arkansas. Why the long trip all the way from Wisconsin? Wildlife experts believe Bruno has been looking for a mate. Next on Statewide, the COVID pandemic has put tens of millions of people out of work and dramatically changed the American way of life. It's not an easy time to open a business. Eric Stock talked with several entrepreneurs who are trying to fulfill their dreams during this time of uncertainty.
Diora Hyderova opened Jack's Restaurant in Normal in March. She named it for her son. It serves Mediterranean cuisine with an American flair. Hyderova says the first week was great. Then the state shut everything down because of COVID-19.
We didn't know about this pandemic and all this stuff, and we were already to be weekends, and we got a lot of products, and suddenly we closed, and I felt bad.
Hyderova says the restaurant closed for 3.5 months. Jack's reopened with half the staff. It relies on carryout and delivery for half its business. Dining capacity remains limited, and Hyderova says many aren't ready.
The numbers going higher, and then I feel like people still scared to go out and eat as before. They don't feel like as before safe.
Hyderova says some customers have come back since reopening. She's counting on social media and good food and service to keep them coming back. A restaurant experience is about more than food. Atmosphere can build customer loyalty, but there's no dining experience when customers aren't allowed inside. John Fritson is opening a fine casual restaurant in a restored train depot in Lexington that he can't wait for people to see.
It's truly a unique building and a dining room and area, and that people really, anytime they come in here, I mean, just like people are just like, they can't believe the transformation that this building's gone through, and that they're really excited to be able to finally come out and dine.
Fritson says he's counting on ambiance and food to make Lexington social, a regional destination. Lexington itself has just 2,000 people. Fritson delayed opening a few months when the pandemic hit. He says COVID-19 actually took pressure off his timeline to open. Lexington Social has done curbside and delivery the last few weeks. Fritson says he scaled down the menu to focus on entrees that travel well and can fit tighter budgets.
It's hard to get people, you know, to pay that kind of a price and then to maintain the quality where people get that value. So that's the adjustments, I suppose, that we've made.
Fritson says during stressful times like this, people want comfort food. He plans to open the dining room by the end of the month. The pandemic presents challenges for retail as well as restaurants. Stores rely on walk-in traffic, and fewer customers want to go outside right now, even with a partial reopening of the state. Erica Zilm opened La La Boutique, a women's clothing store in downtown Bloomington, in late June.
It was a really scary thing to open a business in general. It was even scarier to open it during a time when we were dealing with something that we've never dealt with before. And I think just staying focused, staying positive, and knowing that we'll get through this. We're all in it together.
Zome opened the boutique with her mother just as Illinois moved from phase 3 to 4. In a strange way, she says the timing worked.
Everybody was itching to kind of get out a little bit and shop local. And, you know, everybody's been cooped up for a couple of months. So they were anxious to come out, and we felt that support for sure that weekend.
Zome says her clothing store not only offers curbside service for many leery about setting foot inside the store, they'll ship too. Even so, she says a boutique doesn't present the same health risks as a restaurant. Groups of customers tend to be smaller, and they don't linger as long. Even as these new business owners have taken a deep breath and opened their doors, others struggle and some have closed for good. No one thinks it'll get easier anytime soon. I'm Eric Stock.
Though many people who have been seriously ill from COVID-19 are older or have underlying health conditions, it's still unclear what causes certain people to get really sick. Aquarius Bunch is from Waterloo, Iowa. She was a healthy 27-year-old working at an assisted living facility when she got COVID-19, and she was pregnant. Natalie Krebs brings us her story.
When Aquarius Bunch tested positive for COVID-19, she quarantined alone at home, hoping to ride out her fever and cough.
I was taking several baths and showers a day. I was checking my temperature. I was drinking tea. I was staying hydrated.
But Bunch never got better. Instead, she got sicker to the point where she went to the emergency room in Waterloo, a small town in eastern Iowa.
I really don't remember much. I just remember they were checking my temperature. They gave me some Tylenol, and I thought I was getting ready to go home. That's what I remember.
It was there Bunch's condition deteriorated fast. She had a seizure, and doctors decided she would need to be transferred to Iowa City, some 80 miles away.
And so they quickly contacted our team at the University of Iowa.
Sharon Beth Larson is a doctor at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. She says there was something else to worry about.
To say we have a COVID-19 patient who has a periviable fetus. So this is a fetus at an age where it is not likely to survive outside the uterus.
Not only did Bunch have COVID-19, she was 6 months pregnant and her lungs were failing.
She was, at that point, not responsive. She was sedated. She was paralyzed. She was on the mechanical ventilator.
Larson, a heart surgeon, was called in because Bunch needed more than that ventilator to survive. Her organs still weren't getting enough oxygen, and so her only chance was a complex, invasive life support procedure known as ECMO. Larson says ECMO is used on just 1-2% of the sickest COVID-19 patients. It involves surgically attaching tubes and monitors to pump oxygen into the blood. This would give Bunch's lungs a chance to heal.
And then we can wean the support and let the patient continue to recover.
But odds were against Bunch. Larson says when COVID-19 patients get to the point where they're placed on ECMO therapy, less than half survive. Plus, there was the issue of the pregnancy. Larson says patients on ECMO nearly always undergo emergency deliveries.
There's bleeding complications. There's thrombotic or blood clot complications. So we were doing the very best we could in this very rare and unique situation.
Larson says during the hour that it took to do the procedure, the room was tense, filled with emotion. A maternal fetal medicine team monitored Bunch's baby the whole time, ready to deliver if necessary. But it wasn't, and Bunch made it through.
I remember waking up, and I was on Zoom with my family, and they were waving at me, smiling, and, you know, talking to me. And I just thought I was in a dream. I thought it was a dream.
Bunch and her lungs improved rapidly, so much so that a little over a week later, she was taken off of ECMO. The next day, her ventilator was removed. And just 2 weeks after Bunch arrived in Iowa City by air ambulance, she was sent home to Waterloo to her mother and 3-year-old son.
It was actually on Mother's Day. I got to come home, so that was great. That was amazing. That worked out well.
Bunch says in the whirlwind of what happened, she never got to talk to Larson while in the ICU. She met her at a checkup appointment after leaving the hospital.
I felt very emotional because, you know, she saved my life. Like, it was just, I was so glad to be able to see her and express my feelings and emotions about how I felt.
and Larson says Bunch has been a source of inspiration during what she calls a dark and disturbing few months at the university hospital battling COVID-19.
Maybe things will never be normal again in the hospital, but it just felt so good that we conquered this virus, that Aquarius conquered this virus that has taken out so many of our friends and family and loved ones and colleagues.
Bunch is now at home in Waterloo. Her baby girl is due in August. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Natalie Krebs.
Kids will need to wear masks when they return to class this year. Tim Shelley shares a doctor's advice on how to get kids comfortable with it.
Dr. Terry Ho, a pediatrician with OSF Healthcare, recommends parents start talking with their children now.
This can be a difficult discussion to have with them. Masks may be scary, they may be uncomfortable, but we as parents can help them. We can relate wearing masks to something they already know.
He says it can help to explain it to kids the same way parents tell kids to cough into their elbows or cover their mouth when they sneeze. He also recommends practicing wearing masks at home and letting kids choose their own masks.
We can lead by example. As parents, our children look to us for reassurance. If we wear a mask, they will too.
Medical experts say wearing a mask remains one of the most effective measures to prevent the spread of COVID-19. The American Academy of Pediatrics recently issued a statement calling for schools to set the goal of in-person learning for the healthy development and well-being of children. Dr. Ho backs that goal.
I know that school reopening is a very stressful and scary topic. We don't want to get this wrong, because if we do, it has to deal with our kids. I want you to all know that you can do this, though.
I'm Tim Shelley.
And a new school year also brings new teachers. They'll start their profession this fall behind a mask in front of a class of students wearing them as well. The last semester before becoming a teacher is usually spent prepping for high-stakes certification exams and student teaching at a school nearby. But of course, that did not happen this year. Susie Yan with member station WBEZ has more on the new class of teachers.
Destiny Cambium was a student teacher in a third grade classroom at Salcedo Elementary in Chicago's Little Village neighborhood before the pandemic hit. During the stay-at-home order, she had to settle for making videos for her students.
I don't get to assess them like I would a normal read aloud because they can't ask me questions because it's recorded.
She was able to join some of the virtual classes, but only to say hi and follow along with the lesson. This class of teachers is the first wave getting certified during a pandemic, and they graduate after getting a first-hand look at the successes and failures of remote learning. They're also heading into their first teaching jobs without taking some high-stakes licensure tests and the required student teaching hours. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed an executive order in April that allows them to get their license without fulfilling those normal requirements. Vicki Trinder is with the College of Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She says she's confident in this group of graduates' ability to quickly pivot. They've gone through a lot.
Now, this group also experienced the strike in the fall. So look at how resilient they are. They're smiling, right? They didn't mind being they've managed to pull everything off even then. But we did have a number of things that along the way were different this time.
The Illinois State Board of Education is setting aside money from the Federal CARES Act for virtual coaching and professional development to help an estimated 4,000 new teachers entering the field. The agency is also working on updated recommendations for remote learning that will include guidance for new teachers. Cesar Palafox recently graduated from UIC and is hoping to teach at a CPS school. He says he learned more about technology and e-learning than he ever expected during remote learning. And he also recognized the challenges of teaching bilingual students. He says that an equitable remote learning plan needs to consider how teachers interact with their parents, too.
They're learning from home now. So not only for them to understand, but also find a way for their parents to help them out in case they need any help.
Schools will be able to open in the fall under certain requirements, but ISBE recommends districts have remote learning plans ready if there is a surge in COVID cases. Paulo Folks says his college program focused a lot on how to make school the best learning environment for students. That's going to be a challenge to shift back home, especially for a first-year teacher.
For a lot of these students, the best learning environment is at school, and it might be the only safe learning environment that they have. So you got to try to like figure out how can you support them from your own home.
Trinder says this time offered pre-service teachers valuable lessons about education. She says people, not just those in education, are looking at schools differently than before. She gives examples of how private groups offered help for e-learning.
People were looking differently at supporting education, and that was brings a lot of hope for me. So even if we look, you know, somewhat like this in the fall, the hope, I think, eventually we won't lose those good parts.
She says a community that wraps around its school can be key to successful learning, whether it's in person or remote. Susie Ahn, WBEZ News.
That's all the time we have for this episode of Statewide. Be with us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this week's show or past shows, they're all available at statewideshow.com. Our podcast can be found through the NPR One app. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. There's more information at aarp.org/near you. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.